What a great way to start, isn't it? Just for the sake of information, a little shout out here. Who is a student here tonight? Excellent, excellent. You're going to learn something. Who here teaches students here tonight? Excellent. Yes, now who here is not any of those things but wants education to be something we can be proud of again? There you go. Where it's not too difficult to find out why you're all here. It's wonderful to see you all. My name's Fred Wooden. I'm the senior minister here at Fountain Street Church, a place that has been bringing people like Jonathan Kozol to this location for 100 years. If you've got your program there, I want you to take a deep breath and mentally put yourself here at other times and other locations and imagine that you're sitting in the same room where Robert F. Kennedy Jr. spoke. Some of you were here. Or Kwesi Mfume. Think of Paul Robeson singing here. There's a thought. Think about Helen Keller. Malcolm X. Ben Spock, Gloria Steinem. You're here perhaps to catch a moment of history. If not for the country, then certainly for you. That's the whole point. And I'm here to tell you a little bit about how this evening's going to go. First of all, we want to thank Darla Jewell and all those wonderful young folk who gave a little extra time for us tonight. I'd like to let you know that there are pencils with pieces of paper nearby, and that way you can write down a question that you think you'd like to have offered to Jonathan Kozol after he gives his primary performance or his presentation. That will be collected so that we can sort through for duplication, and we'll read some of them so he can address them. So if you have a burning issue, write it down, and we'll be collecting them toward the end of the presentation. If you would like him to sign a book that you purchase here tonight, those are the conditions. He will be in our social hall following, so I want you to make sure that you know that he will be here, and he'll be doing that for you. He'll be signing copies of Letters to a Young Teacher and Shame of the Nation. If you are hanging around looking to get your book signed, you don't have to be bored, because a number of school and community groups are here to let you know that they are trying to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And if you'd like to learn more about them, including all the organizations you see listed, many of the organizations you see listed in your program, do stop by. Meet people you may not have known before but are working on the same things you're going to do. That's all the logistics we have. So I need to introduce someone else, but I also need to welcome Mr. Kozol up to the stage, because he wants to hear all these introductions, after all. He's a man that likes to appreciate good words. So I'm going to look back here and see if he's ready. Give me just a moment. Every time we hold an event like this, we ask for someone special that is larger than Fountain Street Church, which is hard to do, by the way, to present our guest speaker and perhaps to introduce others here. We're particularly proud that this evening our introducer of note is no less than His Honor, as we used to call him in Chicago, but he's not in Chicago, George Hartwell, who is not only the mayor of this great city, but he also happens to be the father of one of my members. So as far as I'm concerned, that makes him even better, and he's married to one of the great activists in this city. So George, if you could come up here and begin to give us a sense of why this is such an important evening. Good to see you. Good to see you here, George. I want to make one final note here. I was just reminded that we are continuing to serve as the host for the Diversity Initiative of GRCC, and their first presenter will be this coming Wednesday, a week from today. Marcelo Suarez Orozco will be here, and you can be here to hear more about this subject. So this is not the first and or the only time I expect to see you here. George, will you be back then?
I'll be back.
Oh, you'll be back. All right, George, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Fred. And I thought we were going to share this pulpit. It ain't big enough for the two of us, man. Of course, it is yours. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me add my words of welcome to those of Dr. Wooden, and how wonderful and how significant to look out and see such a full house for this important presentation here in Grand Rapids this evening. I could go on about the impact that Jonathan Kozol has had on me and my life, beginning with Rachel and her children, which was published just as I was beginning my own career in ministry with the homeless, and how that book and the wisdom in it shaped the ministry that I did with here at Heartside Ministry for 14 years, or how subsequent books, Savage Inequalities, Amazing Grace, and most recently, The Shame of a Nation, how those have helped helped me frame the issues of public education in America today, and inspire me to commit time and energy as mayor of the city to our Grand Rapids Public Schools. I could go on about that, but that's not what I am up here. So I'm up here to say thank you to some people tonight. And so let me start by listing for you our sponsors this evening. The event sponsor is Creative Learning, Kathy Albro. The series student ticket sponsor is the Meyer Corporation. Media sponsor is Michigan Radio. The gold sponsor is the Aquinas School of Education. Another gold sponsor is Yesterdog, Bill and Susan Lewis. And then the more than 30 individual sponsors who are seated here in the front three rows this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, would you join me in thanking our sponsors? This event is also made possible because of the generous cooperation of Grand Valley State University, College of Interdisciplinary Studies, Susan Mendoza, Susan Mendoza-Jones, who is the Director of Integrative Learning. Did I say that right? Integrative? Integrative. Is that okay, Mr. Superintendent? Okay. I graduated from another district. And it is also made possible because of the cooperation of the Grand Rapids Student Advancement Foundation, Susan Hartwell, director. And as a matter of fact, a portion of the proceeds of tonight's event will go to the Student Advancement Foundation to support public education in Grand Rapids. I also want to thank the members of the Great Speakers Committee at Fountain Street Church and the many, many volunteers who are here tonight and who helped make this possible. It is now my pleasure to introduce the man who will introduce the man. Let me bring forward Dr. Bernard Taylor, the superintendent of the Grand Rapids Public Schools. And as he's coming forward, say that that already in his now in his second year as superintendent of our schools, he has made his mark. The relationship that Dr. Taylor and I enjoy as superintendent and mayor is, I think, quite unusual and rare, I believe, among mayors and superintendents. Rare in a good sense, in a positive sense. Now, with Blakey, it was a different... Well, that was rare. But Dr. Taylor is making a significant mark in this community in already in a short time and leading our schools... building on the foundation of Bert Blakey before him and leading our schools to great new heights. So join me, please, in welcoming to the mic.
Wow, this is very impressive. I mean, I'm just going to stick to what I was asked to do because you give me a microphone and a platform, we could be here all night. I have the high honor and pleasure to introduce Jonathan Kozel and his biography, his career achievements, his works are all listed for you, and I'm sure that you have taken the time to read this information. But I think that in introducing him, I think that we should recognize that we are going to hear from an icon in public education. We're going to hear from someone who I believe has very accurately characterized what is going on in public education, and in particular urban public education in the United States today. I think that what he is going to do for all of us is to provide the context by which we need to be viewing what truly is an asset, one that we cannot allow to become a diminished one, because children are involved, and children only get one chance to get a quality education. And it's not something that should be bartered. It's not something that should be a political football. It shouldn't be something that some take as a given and others hope and pray that it is done well and done right. I think that this community stands at a very important juncture in terms of what education should be here. I'm convicted to believe that if we can figure out what to do here in Grand Rapids, we can serve as an example for this country in terms of what a quality urban public education can and should be. The other thing that I hope that we do is never apologize for being what we are. We serve children who may be eligible for free and reduced lunch, who may need special education services, and who might not right now speak English. But we do that proudly, we do that with a sense of purpose, and we certainly should feel privileged to do it. So I heartily and proudly embrace the fact that whether we're the third largest, fourth largest, 20th largest, or the smallest district in Michigan, who we serve deserves the best that we have to offer. And we need to do that every day without equivocation, without fear, and without any sense of shame for who we serve and why we serve them. I think Jonathan Kozol's works very clearly delineate the problems. He also is giving insights to how we can attack those problems. But as FDR said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. So I'm not afraid. I think we are going to have fun and improve our condition and make our children understand they can be whatever they want to be whenever they choose to be great. So without further ado, and with great pride and honor, I introduce to you Jonathan Kozol.
What a wonderful crowd. Are there any teachers here tonight? Oh, look at that. I always feel safer when I'm in a room of teachers. Thank you very much, Dr. Taylor, and thanks also to the mayor of this great city, one of the most extraordinary people I have yet to meet in public life. Remarkable man. And my sincere gratitude to Reverend Wooden and the amazing Wendy Marty and everybody else from this historic church for making me feel welcome with you here tonight. People tell me that my newest book, just published, Letters to a Young Teacher, is the first cheerful book I've ever written. I think that's because I wrote it as a tribute and an invitation to what I believe to be a beautiful profession. I'm not going to speak about it much tonight because I need to talk to you about more solemn matters. I'll simply say that it's a year of letters to an absolutely incandescent, idealistic and adoring first grade teacher, starting out at an inner city school, as it happens in my own hometown of Boston, who wrote to me, as teachers often do, and asked me if I'd visit with her children. And then, of course, as soon as I arrived, put me right to work. Teachers always do that to me. They say, don't just stand there, teach something. You write the books, let's see if you can still do it. And naturally, I'd mess things up. And when I did, she scolded me mercilessly right in front of the children. One day in the fall, she asked me if I would give the kids a short sentence of non-fiction narrative. I didn't pay attention. And I gave them a long sentence about animals who talk. She had this delicious sense of humor first grade teachers often have. Immediately told the kids I hadn't listened carefully. Mr. Jonathan, she said, because they couldn't say my last name. They couldn't pronounce it. In fact, they couldn't even say, a lot of little kids can't pronounce that TH, so they call me Mr. Jonifer. She said, Mr. Jonifer, she said, has not acted like a grown-up. And she asked the children how I should be punished. And they voted that I needed a timeout. And they made me go and sit in the corner on the reading rug where I had to hold a big stuffed bear. And one of the children felt bad for me, so when she wasn't looking, he snuck over and stuck a decal of a green frog on my forehead. I came to love that classroom, and I kept visiting for an entire year, watching that mystical chemistry of trust and love evolve between the children and their teacher. That's something you never hear about in these federal laws, like No Child Left Behind. You know, you never hear about that beautiful chemistry that forms. When they come to us in September, they're little strangers. In June, we cry to say goodbye. And I gloried in watching this beautiful young teacher developing the skills those children needed to survive. Even though I never saw her teach a test prep lesson the entire year. She refused to drill her children in order to artificially inflate their scores, but filled the room with her own contagious sense of merriment and jubilation at the joy of being in the company of children. And the natural exhilaration that those little pint-sized people brought into her room. And in the end, most of the kids did very well on their exams, which teaches us, in my belief, the difference between learning out of fear of an examination and learning from the satisfaction and excitement of the act of learning for its own good sake alone. Now, there are those who tell us that black children, all the children in her class were black. It was a classic segregated school. There are those who tell us that black children are so different from white children that they require a totally unique curriculum. They think differently, the sociologists have told us. They're cognitively unique. Leave the curiosity and merriment to children in the suburbs. Let the children in the suburbs ask intriguing questions. Drill these inner city kids to parrot the right answers. Give them a rigid, uniform curriculum, marching them onward to the destination of the next high stakes exam. Don't allow them the whimsical delight of following a longing or a curiosity that comes from their own soul. That's the luxury of suburban children. Black kids can't afford that wasted time. In many of these schools, they've canceled recess in order to leave more time to drill the children for exams. Chicago has abolished recess. Atlanta is now building public schools without playgrounds. So even if a future superintendent should come to the conclusion that it might be healthy for these kids to play, especially at a moment when obesity stalks the black community in the United States, highest risk of diabetes, young black women in America right now. They're canceling recess in order to drill these children for exams. Francesca rejected all of this. When I told her that some experts say black kids learn differently from anybody else, she answered bravely, "I refuse to treat them as a different species from the mainstream of America. Give them," she said, "the same rich opportunities that you and I received, and they will blossom like the flowers that they are." And she also resisted something else that's coming to be all too common in our inner city schools. A lot of these urban schools are underfunded. I'll get to that in a moment. That's no surprise to many of you. And sometimes the very same corporate leaders, and I don't want to insult anybody here in Grand Rapids, so let's assume I mean all the other cities in America. Because people here have been so nice to me. But sometimes the very same corporate leaders who resist equitable allocation of resources, who refuse to see their own property values decline a point or two by risking equal allocation of funds for children in poor neighborhoods. You know how that works. Outside New York, real estate firms advertise that a home that's on sale is near a highly funded, high-performing school, raises the value of the home. The very same corporate forces that resist equality then form business partnerships with the schools they've cheated in order to offer them occasional philanthropy. I'm glad to get philanthropy wherever it comes from, you know, and some of these are very good, benevolent people. But unfortunately, in many of these cities, the consequence of this is that the principals of these schools become so indebted and feel so indebted to their business benefactors that they begin to adopt their language and their ideology. And, you know, you see it in a very vivid way. This is not happening in the suburbs. This would not happen in most white suburbs. But I come into schools in many inner city areas. I'm thinking of one school district in which I was just stunned to find this when I walked into these all-black schools. I won't name the district because I don't want to humiliate people there.
Well, why not? This is in Columbus, Ohio, and I walk into an all-black school, and I go to the principal's office, and I say to the person behind the desk, "Are you the principal?" Which makes sense because it says principal's office on the door. She says, and she gets nervous about this. It's a funny kind of little minuet that takes place, an odd semantic ballet or something. And she says, I'd rather not speak of myself as the principal of the school. I like to think that I'm the building CEO. In another school in Columbus, the principal said, I like to think of myself as the building manager. I said, how do you think of the teachers? She said, those are the classroom managers. And I wanted to say to these women who both, they were both women and both very nice people, actually. I wanted to say, why are you talking that way? Is that why you studied Plato and Rousseau, Piaget, Erickson, the great Robert Coles? And in the school, the first school I mentioned, on the wall of the kindergarten, there was a mission statement. Now, schools do this, and it's normal to have a mission, but this was a strange mission. It said, the mission, that, now mind you, this was in kindergarten, said the mission of our school is to develop products that will sharpen our nation's competitive edge in global markets, in the global marketplace, to be exact. And I remember thinking, they wouldn't dare do that out in the beautiful white suburb in which I grew up, because the parents would be offended. They would want their children to have the amplitude of options that all the varieties of life and career might offer them. They wouldn't want to think of their children as little embryonic economic units, future deficits or assets for the global marketplace. But in these inner city schools, indebted as they are to the private sector, they often have no choice, and they fall into this peculiar pattern. So, you know, it said to develop products that will sharpen our competitive edge in the global marketplace. And I just thought, well, maybe if that, I saw that in high school, it wouldn't offend me, but kindergarten? What? Why should little six-year-olds care about the global marketplace? They care about belly buttons, itchy elbows, fuzzy caterpillars. Francesca, again, rejected all of this. She said, I refuse to steal away their childhood. I loved her for saying that. Let me tell you, there are thousands of high-spirited and glorious young people like Francesca in our public schools. And more of them will be coming into these schools in the years immediately ahead, because I meet them in the universities everywhere I go. They tell me they want to teach, and they want to teach not simply in the public schools, they want to teach in the poorest public schools, because they believe these schools are the front lines of American democracy. Our universities are filled with these wonderful idealists and exciting people too. And I recruit them all the time. If they're boring, I don't recruit them. If they're flat, dull, robotic, predictable, don't laugh at my jokes, I say, you can go to business school. Sorry. You can go to law school. Go to Harvard Law. But if they're jubilant and passionate and have that thrilling sense of going into the public schools in order to bring beauty and mystery and magic and mischief into the hearts of little people, I say, come on, we need you. And don't go to the suburbs, even though your mom would probably prefer that. But come into the schools where we need you most. And they do. But 50% of them who come into our urban schools quit within 3 years. When I ask them why they're quitting, they never blame it on the children. Very rarely do they. They love the children. They fall in love with their students. The kids tend to adore them because they're glowing young souls. And they don't blame the parents either. They're very careful about not scapegoating the parents. And they don't blame the neighborhood. Again and again, when I ask them why they're disillusioned, why they think that they might quit, the first answer I hear is, quote, this nightmare of standardized testing, this testing mania that's being forced upon us by No Child Left Behind. They tell me they hate this law. Now, the dull teachers don't tell me this. The robotic teachers, there are a few. Most teachers I find are of higher quality than I've seen in many, many years. But there's some robotic types. They don't object to it because the testing agenda tells them exactly what to do. It's prescriptive. They're handed scripted text to use in school. It spares them the burden of thinking. It rescues them from exposing their own soul and character to the children. The less of the life of a mind a person brings into the classroom, the less that person suffers by genuflecting to this abased curriculum. But the exhilarating teachers, the teachers who are in love with poetry, the teachers who have read history in college, the teachers who have studied philosophy and anthropology, as Francesca did. Francesca was reading the books of Paul Goodman. Remember him? When she was 14 years old, she brought wonderful, rich, multicultural material to her children, but she also read them William Butler Yeats, first grade. And she read them the sonnets of the German poet Rilke. Beautiful sonnet on autumn, little children loved. Of course, they couldn't read these poems, but they would seize words out of these poems. And in this way, they built their own vocabularies. And she did teach phonics, too. A lot of people think, oh, she's probably that, you know, one of those wheat germ types. From the, you know, leftover from the 70s, from the Beatles era, who are afraid of phonics. No, she taught them phonics, but not out of one of those pit-pat scripted readers which bore the kids to death. The classic one I see in dozens of all-black schools, although I've never seen it in a white school, it's a set of little books. Each little booklet teaches the kids a sound, but they have no plot, no pictures, and absolutely zero value as literature. I remember the one called, this might be like a classic, of worthless pedagogy. It was called Sad Sam. That's not going to pep you up on Monday morning. And it had only one sentence. The only sentence in the story was, Sad Sam sat on the sand. And then the teachers have to ask the child to predict what's going to happen next. So the kids say, I don't know. He keeps sitting there, you know?
teachers that have a wonderful, rich education, precisely the teachers we want the most to bring into these urban schools, well-prepared as teachers, but also well-educated as human beings. These are the ones that hate this testing regimen the most. I'm telling you. Even worse is the distortion of curriculum because of the tight timing in these schools. See, I know good principals who will say to me, Jonathan, they won't say this at school, they'll say this after school. A lot of principals who have very good educational values will tell me honestly, they are forcing upon their teachers methods of instruction they personally abhor. Had a teacher, one of the principals in Columbus, Ohio, asked me as I was leaving her school, after all this, you know, uniform marching and self-help slogans, which is typical in these schools, if it is to be, it's up to me. They make these little black kids chant this, which is a terrible lie. It may be good therapy, but it's certainly not an accurate description of reality. These little kids, it's not up to them to allocate the same funding for their ghetto school in Detroit that is being spent on kids in Bloomfield Hills, you know? And she took me aside and she said, do you have time tonight? I said, sure I do. I was touched by this sudden turnaround. It was an African-American woman, and I just something in her eyes touched me. And we went out to dinner, and we had a little wine, and then a little more wine. And then she just poured her heart out, and she said, this would be rejected out of hand in any middle-class suburban school. She said, we not only have apartheid schools now, we have an apartheid curriculum. And, you know, one of the things teachers tell me they hate the most is that because of the tight timing, they're often forced to hold timers in their hands. This is true in Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, so that every minute of the day is provably focused on a specific skill that's stipulated under No Child Left Behind. You follow me? Or under the state version. And, you know, so that if it's 11:25, you have to be teaching English language skill number 67B. And you're usually required to put the number on the chalkboard. Have you ever heard of that? Well, that's true in the majority of black schools in America now. You have to write on the blackboard something like, I saw this once in New York. It said, English Language Arts 67B. Students will demonstrate, does this sound familiar to you? Children will demonstrate their proficiency, big word for little people, you know, in producing a narrative procedure. So I stood there, and I looked at the teacher. This was fifth grade. And I thought, I majored in English at Harvard. I don't know what that means. What does it mean? And I kept thinking, how do you produce a procedure? I don't think you can do it. You know, I think you produce a screwdriver. You carry out a procedure. So I asked the teacher, and he said, it's rotten syntax, but I have no choice. I have to put that on the board. I said, well, why don't you just write it in your own language? And he said, I'm not allowed to. I'll be in trouble. Our school is considered low performing. We're on an improvement plan. Have you ever heard of that? This is the improvement plan, to talk in Orwellian doublespeak, you know? So I said, well, what does it mean? What the heck does that mean? Produce a narrative procedure, he laughs. He says, it just means to write a story.
Now, the worst of this is that exuberant children, especially little ones around 6 years old and 7 years old, you know, they're gifted artists at subverting lesson plans. I think that's an entitlement God gave them. We teachers, we slave all Sunday night to get our lessons down for the week, and then these little rambunctious kids ruin it on Tuesday morning. So there's the teacher up at the board, and I'll say she because it's usually a woman in elementary school, and she's trying so hard to obey the rules. She's trying not to be a rebel. She doesn't want to make things hard for her principal. They're worried about their AYP. That's an odd expression. It means proof that you're improving every single year, you know. And so she's got it all on the blackboard, or the green board nowadays, or actually the white board nowadays, the dry erase board. And so the little boy raises his hand, and he says, "Miss Francesca?" And she thinks, maybe he's going to help me deliver this proficiency. You have to say deliver, you see, it's part of the jargon. Or facilitate delivery of the proficiency, you know. The more polysyllables, the better. And or replicate the facilitation, you know, something. Or utilize it. You can't just say use, you have to utilize. There's a whole double speak there because it's the jargon of insecure semi-intellectuals who write the standards. When I was a student at Harvard, I was blessed to study for 2 years. I was only a junior, but I was admitted to a graduate seminar taught by a wonderful man, a poet named Archibald MacLeish. And he sat me down the first week in class, and he said, "Jonathan, whenever you find you're using big Latinate pretentious polysyllables to express a concept you could get across in simple words, be suspicious of your motives." You know? And so anyway, there she is trying to deliver the proficiency and facilitate the delivery. And little boy says, "Miss Francesca," and she thinks, maybe he's going to help me. So she takes a chance and she says, "What, sweetie?" And he says, "Guess what?" Because kids never tell you anything. You have to guess. So she says, "What?" And he says, "Yesterday, on Sunday afternoon, my aunt and uncle took me to the zoo. And guess what?" And now she's lost. You know, she's lost it now. But she's stuck. She has to say, "What?" Because you have to say, "What?" when they do that. And he says, "And I saw a baby bear that had just been born." And off he goes, piling on the ands and buts for one of those glorious, eternal, run-on sentences at which six-year-olds are almost as good as William Faulkner. And sometimes, if you listen, at the end of all those ands and buts, there's a piece of hidden treasure where that little boy or girl unveils a secret from their soul, something you never knew about them up until that time. And good teachers use that piece of hidden treasure as a key to unlock motivation. And they still do it in the good suburban schools where the anxiety level is low and they know their kids are going to do well on the tests anyway. And besides, they can't be punished by the federal law, because the only way you can punish a school under NCLB is to withhold Title I, federal money. The best suburbs can thumb their nose at that money. Just raise the property tax 0.2% on everybody who has more than 3 swimming pools, you know, something like that. Or hot tub. For that, I'd raise it $6. But But in the inner city schools, they desperately need that money. They can't take that risk. And so they have to interrupt that little boy. And they never find that treasure. And they never know what secrets lie within his soul. One of my greatest mentors in education, perhaps the person from whom I've learned more than any other man or woman of our times. It'll surprise you. It's not somebody they read in schools of education, though they should. But it's somebody that I'll bet every one of you would love to have been able to spend a day of your life with. Yes, I do end sentences with prepositions. Remember what Winston Churchill said about that? Somebody chastised him for ending a sentence with a preposition, and he said, such criticism is an insult up with which I shall not put. Isn't that great? I'll tell you who this was. This was a wonderful man who asked me if he could come with me to the South Bronx, where many of my books take place. We were in New York together to speak to the American Montessori Society. And the next day he said, could I go up and visit the kids that you write about? He'd come to like this little girl, Pineapple, that I describe in a lot of my books, and a little boy named Mario. And so I'll tell you who it was. I don't bring many people up there because you can't put poor kids on display, you know. But this was somebody I knew they'd like to meet. I was sure they would love to meet. His name was Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. This was 10 years ago, and he's such a humble man. He said, the only thing is I won't go up if you think my presence will intimidate those children. I looked at him and thought, how could he intimidate anybody? So I teased him. I said, I'll bet they can handle it, you know. And up we went, and he wanted to know how I usually go. And I said, actually, the train is the quickest way, number 6 train. It's just 12 minutes from the richest 10-block area of the Western world, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, to the poorest congressional district in America. We went on the train. And he got all excited. He liked the New York subway, and I was excited, too. I felt like a child. I kept looking around me and thinking, wow, I'm on the New York subway with Mr. Rogers. And we came up to the neighborhood, and I kept thinking, you know, what I was saying before, those black children think different, they act different, they learn different. I thought maybe nobody will know who he is if they're that different. Nonsense, you know. We walked half a block, actually, and a truck came screeching to a halt, and the driver, who was a middle-aged black man, jumped out of the truck and lifted Fred Rogers off the ground, kissed him. We went to a public school, and the kindergarten and first and second grade teachers just cried to have him come in there, and he listened to the children. See, he was a great listener. He taught us to listen. He said it's in those moments where we create a silence that the spiritual beauty of the children is revealed. Did you know he was a theologian? He was ordained in the Presbyterian Church. He was a minister with a ministry to children. And then I took him to an after school at an Episcopal church nearby, which didn't try to compete with the public schools by setting up one of those little boutique, you know, charter schools or anything like that, but supported the public schools. And we walked in, and it was packed after school. There were 90 children there. And this little boy, Mario, whom I'd known since he was 6, by now he was 8, one of these little kids who, if he doesn't like you, he makes that painfully obvious, you know? But if he likes you, you're in for it. He spots Mr. Rogers from way across the room. He goes right at him like a World War II attack plane, or a little, I thought of him like a little jet-powered bumblebee because he's a little plump with his wings spread wide. At the moment of collision, he wraps them around Mr. Rogers' head, looks him right in the eyes, kisses him on the forehead, and says, "Welcome to my neighborhood, Mr. Rogers." Fred never forgot that to the year he died. He never forgot that. I miss him so much. Couple final points. Perhaps what good teachers consider most unfair is that the testing pressure starts so early now in public school, third grade by federal law. And in many schools, it starts in first grade or kindergarten because the schools are so frightened that they won't score well in third grade that they start drilling them in kindergarten. It's like test prep on how to take the test. It has nothing to do with content, nothing to do with culture. It's like bubble prep. You know how to fill in bubbles and how to think, you know, how to eliminate the most unlikely question. It has nothing to do with learning. It's just strategy and trickery. There are some schools in California, at least 10 other states I know, where they give these bubble tests starting in September of the kindergarten year. Little kids that age, unless they've had pre-K, how many kindergarten teachers are there here? Well, as kindergarten teachers will tell you, a lot of little kids that age come from poor families, don't yet know that text goes left to right. So they hold the little exam book upside down on their desk. A lot of them can't manipulate a pencil yet. They can't fill in the bubbles. I couldn't even do it well when I was in 12th grade. I mean, number two pencil. I still hate it because the pencil tip would always break. I always thought, what would happen to the kid who brought in a number three pencil? You know, that would be, you know, Henry David Thoreau or somebody, you know. And, you know, and the little kids pee in their pants. They cry, they throw up. The teacher can't help them. Those are the rules. All she can say is, all by yourself, keep on. I sometimes wonder who designs these miseries for children. What's happening in America now? Where did this punitive ethos come from? Sometimes I think there's a small group of sociopaths in Washington. And, you know, in someplace like a little room in the basement of the Heritage Foundation, where they're just, you know, trying. Anyway, if at least these kids got pre-K education, if at least they got good preschool, they might have a chance at passing these exams. But the vast majority of inner city children in America still, after all these years, don't receive preschool education for even half a day for 1 year. As my friend, my beloved friend, Marion Wright Edelman, could testify to you if she were here today. I'm sure many of you know who Marion is, the great advocates for children in our country. Meanwhile, my Harvard classmates buy their children or grandchildren, depending on how old they are, the most beautiful, rich, developmental preschool, usually starting when they're three, sometimes when they're 2.5. And the top preschools are so desirable in New York City right now, they are known as the Baby Ivies. There's no pretense of a meritocracy, right? This is your ticket to Dartmouth or Brown or Yale. By the little ones I know get nothing. These affluent kids get preschool that now costs, at least in New York and Beverly Hills, to take two extremes, I mean two, the East and the West, and Brentwood, which is wealthier than Beverly Hills, if you know Los Angeles. Typically, these preschools cost $20,000 to $22,000 a year. Can you imagine that? The top ones in New York now cost $24,000 a year. 24 for 2.5-year-olds. Do you know how little a 2.5-year-old is? How much is that per pound? You know? And meanwhile, little ones I know get nothing. But a few years later, they're in third grade, and they all have to take the same standardized exams. Which ones do you think will score proficient or above proficient and be tagged as gifted and talented and maybe put into a special school within a school? You know what I mean? I know you have them here too. And we'll march right on in high school and secondary years to honors and AP and on to the finest universities. And which ones, on the other hand, will be labeled mentally retarded, developmentally delayed, and likely denied promotion? I want to tell you, I don't get too angry. I try not to be angry when I'm with such nice people in a church, but there's something deeply hypocritical in a society that would hold a little girl, a poor little girl, 9 years old in third grade, accountable. That's the big word nowadays. A society that would hold that little girl accountable for her performance on a high-stakes standardized exam, but does not hold the president and Congress accountable for robbing her of what they gave their own kids 7 years before. Two other quick points I'd like to make. Francesca was very lucky. She had a marvelous principal, an African-American woman who was a genius at kind of playing the system. And as a result, she had only 20 children in her class. But that is very, very rare in our overcrowded urban schools. I walk repeatedly into inner city schools where there will be 28 kids in kindergarten at the start of September, 35 in fifth grade, 38 in an 11th grade high school lab. In Los Angeles 2 years ago, I walked into a heartbreaking school, probably, the sort of thing the United States wouldn't want the rest of the world to know about. You know, they won't advertise this on the Voice of America, you know. Fremont High School, South Central LA, 5,000 kids. I saw 6 white kids the whole time I was there. 6. And 2 of them had spiked hair. I figure that's what the statisticians mean by other. You know, other. But the school was so crowded that half the kids in the school had no classrooms. Where did they go to class? In trailers. Trailers lined up in what was once a sports area. No room to play. But they won't call them trailers in California. Nobody wants to admit the richest nation in the world puts its black children, its minority children, into trailers. So you know what they call them in most of the United States. Portables. But in California, they don't even say portables. You know what they call them in California? Bungalows. Bungalows. But they don't look like bungalows. Bungalows are cute little houses with thatched roofs and chimneys where Piglet and Pooh and Tigger would have had a little tea party. These are smelly trailers. And I walked into a class there, wonderful teacher, 40 kids in her 10th grade government class. Not one white kid in the class. I asked her, how many classes like this do you have each day? 6 classes, 40 on average in each. And then I go and visit good suburban schools because you forget sometimes that this is a rich society. If you visit only in these districts, you would think we were in Haiti. You would think this was the third world. So I go back to remember. And I don't just visit the wealthiest suburbs like Grosse Pointe, place like that, or Brookline, Massachusetts, which some of you have heard of probably, or Glencoe, Illinois. I go to just typical suburbs. And I find a third grade with 16 children in the class. 8th grade with maybe 18 to 20. AP classes with 15. And a lot of my friends, wealthy people who live in those towns, don't even send their kids to those top high schools. When they're old enough, they send them away to exclusive boarding schools, prep schools. A lot of them are in New England, near where I live. I happen to live about 20 minutes from a very famous school called Exeter. How many have heard of that? Phillips Academy, Exeter. 20 minutes the other direction is a school called Andover. I am going to confess something to you. I know a lot about those schools because I went to one, very much like the two I mentioned. And I'm going to tell you something. I know this for a fact. I'm not teasing anybody specific. All boys who go to those schools are not the brightest bulbs. I had a lot of dumb boys in my class, but they had the right names, you know. Abbott Cabot was in my class. I still remember that. Now, on a completely unrelated note, I know this is a Republican part of America. President Bush attended Andover. Completely unrelated. And girls are all smart that get in. I don't know why. Even the boys who aren't that bright aren't so motivated to drink their way through their high school years. With 12 in a class, think how much attention they get. You know, think what would happen if we did that for those marginal dropouts in the Grand Rapids schools, for example, you know. But we do it for rich kids. And here's what I'm going to say to you in all seriousness. A very small class size and the wonderful attention this brings every child in the class is good for the son of a president. Or good for the daughter of a big-time business CEO, a lawyer, a psychiatrist, then it's good for the poorest child of the poorest black or Latino or white woman in Grand Rapids or Chicago or L.A. The last thing I'm going to say is that. My friends, I need to end this on a solemn note. We stand right now, in terms of elemental racial justice, at one of the most reactionary moments in our nation's history. The tide is swinging way, way back to where I started out. Black and Latino children at this moment are more segregated, more isolated racially in their public schools than at any time since 1968, the year when Dr. King was taken from us. Meanwhile, the savage inequalities of their segregated schools continue unabated. Little Pineapple, this little girl I liked so much, used to boss me around in the South Bronx. She's the one who used to, she got so impatient with me because I always wore the same black suit and it had holes in it, and she said it was raggedy. And that, I like that word children use. You'd say, grown-ups would say ratty, but she said raggedy, and she once sat me down, folded her arms when she was in third grade, plump little arms, and she looks at me like a counselor, you know, like a therapy person. And she says, "Jonathan, is that the only suit you have?" And I said, "No, I have two, but they're both identical." She said, "Do me a favor, Jonathan. I'd like you to look respectable. If you have enough money, you go to a nice store someday and buy yourself a nice new suit." And she was so persuasive that I did. I went to a nice store and I bought a beautiful new suit. But the problem from her point of view was that it was the same as the old suits. So she sat me down again. By now it's 2 years later in fifth grade. Folds those little arms again, looks me in the eyes and says, "Jonathan, I know you get upset sometimes to see the way we live. You don't always need to dress in black." I always tell young teachers, don't think you're going into these neighborhoods to bring blessings. You go in search of blessings. You'll find them every time, you know. But there's little Pineapple. When she was in fifth grade, she was getting $10,000 a year invested in her public education. That's higher than Grand Rapids, but New York cost of living, That by New York cost of living, that equates to about $5,000, $6,000 anywhere else. You lift a pineapple in your good and decent grown-up arms, and I know this is a decent group of people here tonight. I think we have the salt of the earth in this room tonight. You lift her up in your grown-up arms. You plunk her down. Lift her out of her segregated, underfunded $10,000 school. You plunk her down in the first white suburb, 15 minutes from her front door, just north of New York City. She'd be getting $19,000 put into her public education every year. Lift her up again and put her down out on beautiful Manhasset on Long Island, getting $22,000. We say in church and synagogue, I happen to be Jewish, that all our children are of equal value in the eyes of God. And the eyes of God, my friends, I'm sure they are, but not in the eyes of America. The eyes of America, because of the archaic, undemocratic, unjust way we finance public schools, these little babies that I love, who have befriended me, who have been my salvation, my soul salvation all these years, like those you love so much in your own schools here in Grand Rapids or in Detroit. These are America's cheap children. These are the Walmart babies. You want to see a Saks Fifth Avenue baby, you got to go out to the beautiful white suburbs. Instead of addressing elemental matters of fair play like these, school boards instead are engaging in the, and state boards are encouraging this, the dangerous and short-sighted policy of handing over public schools. Instead of funding them, giving them what they need, they're handing them over to private corporations. That's happening from one coast to the other, I'm telling you. National chains of charter schools, for instance, or pilot schools, or something halfway in between, which may seem benign at first, and sometimes are benign, but which represent an opening wedge for something far more dangerous and not benign at all, known as school vouchers. You know, the single worst idea to come into public discourse about education in my lifetime. I urge you to be very cautious. There are those who say, why not? Why not let this benevolent, decent company run a little school like African American Academy or something like that? That's a typical name. They always use hyperbolic terms like Academy of Success and Enterprise. Or they like that word, enterprise. They're very seldom will you find one that's like Academy of Labor Unions, you know. A lot of enterprise. They have big words like achieve, Achievement Academy, Excellence Academy. That's the terrible banality, you know. Francesca once heard the former Secretary of Education saying, we are demanding that our teachers strive for excellence. And she said, oh, thank you, Secretary of Education. What a radical idea. I never thought of that. I thought I'd studied all these years in order to inculcate mediocrity. There's a terrible banality in the education discourse. But let me tell you something. Vouchers, if we ever had them, wouldn't just go to a benevolent Roman Catholic school or a nice Presbyterian school or a Montessori school or Afro-centered school. Once you let that genie out of the bottle, you can't control it. It will go to David Duke schools and Pat Robertson schools and Jerry Falwell-type schools. It will go to every type of extremist group that wants to start a school in the United States. And it won't just go to ideological or ethnic groups. Corporations will move in. What an opportunity. This is the second largest education, the second largest industry in America after the military. It won't just be the kind of companies you think would be primed for education. It'll be anybody who's good at franchising an idea. McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Burger King already runs a chain of high schools, public schools, public money, private schools. Anyway, this last thing I'm going to say. I've decided it's time to bring this battle right to Washington. And I've been insisting, I've been spending a lot of time there, and I've been insisting that Congress drastically revise this law. I've met with the majority of the Democratic members of the Senate Education Committee that's about to decide what to do about this law. They're going to decide. It'll go to the Senate and House floor in the next 6 weeks. I can't get to the Republicans because for some reason they don't like me as much. But I would. I'd talk to any of them. But I've talked primarily with people who have been my friends for 30 years. I've known since they were in Congress. Wonderful Tom Harkin from Iowa, really good human being. Patty Murray from Washington. Jack Reed from Rhode Island. Bernie Sanders, so forth. Sherrod Brown, a marvelous, spiritual, theologically motivated man from Ohio. I don't mean to leave out your two terrific senators, but none, they're not on the Education Committee, unfortunately. The only one I can't get to is the chair of the committee, whose name is Ted Kennedy. And the reason I couldn't get to him, the other senators told me, and they said it's essential to get to him. They said, no matter how much we agree with you, he's going to call the shots on this. He's now the most powerful member of Congress. He's certainly the most prestigious figure in the Senate with the most seniority, and he's a very good legislator. You know, even Orrin Hatch says so. It must be true. But he wouldn't talk with me, and the other senators said, you know, he made the biggest political mistake of his life. He co-sponsored that law at the president's request. And he regrets it now, but he's locked into it. And it may be very hard for him to make sweeping revisions that take away this whole punitive tone and turn it into a lever of real equality. So I didn't know what to do because he's always been a friend of mine. He's my senator. He's from Massachusetts. When I was a young teacher, he befriended me. Now that suddenly there was this cold stone wall. So you know what I did? I went on a fast. A partial fast, or I wouldn't be standing here. But severe enough that the press in Boston, the reporter, noticed that I'd lost 30 pounds by the end of the summer, and because I started in the end of June, and he wrote a story about it, and he grilled me, why are you doing this? And I said, Ted Kennedy. And suddenly, after 4 months of trying to get through to him, I got a call from his office. And they said they'd call again pretty soon. And then there was another newspaper story that I was getting thinner. And 2 weeks ago, his office called and said that the senator wants to talk with me next Monday at 11 a.m. in person. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you have to put your body on the line for something you believe, even in a small way. Well, you know, I know the things I say make people angry, but I believe we need prophetic voices in our nation at this time. I believe we need our leadership in Washington to rise to this occasion. I believe we need our teachers and school administrators to rise to the prophetic moment too. I believe we need the pastors of our churches and our synagogues speaking out with the simplicity of Jesus and the passion of Isaiah.
on these issues, these painful issues that no one wants to face. The whole No Child Left Behind agenda is an attempt to use tests, rigor, threats, and punishments to do an end run around the terrible reality of separate and unequal education, you see, and a refusal to name that reality. No one wants to name it. They get so mad at me when I say, hey, these are segregated schools, because if I don't see any white children all day, I don't, like, go to my computer and check with Washington. I just say, hey, I can see good. I actually can't, but I have good glasses. I say, I think this is a segregated school, you know? And
I think we need our churches particularly speaking out, not just with kindness, but with indignation, with prophetic fury on this subject. And not simply, and I don't mean this is the last place that I would chastise anybody, because this church is historically a bastion of highly principled, decent human beings. But a lot of churches, they talk a lot about charity, philanthropy, and service. And charity is a blessed thing, but charity is not a substitute for justice, you know. And upsets people, makes people angry when I say these things. It, of course, particularly infuriates the far right wing. They don't like me at all, and they're mean to me. You know, they're like, they're tough. The right wing in America is smart. They've done their homework. They've trained a whole echelon of brilliant young people to go out in public on TV and fight their battles for them. And they do it well. And they do it, and they know how to debate with what I call surgical efficiency. I mean, they can kill you with their words. And I have to debate them, because every TV show needs one liberal. And there are only about 7 or 8 still living, so the others are sick, they call me. And I'm going to tell you, these are mean people. I don't mean thoughtful conservatives like the three in the back row tonight. I mean pathologically evil people, you know, the kind of people you see on Fox TV, you know, sick, mean people whose eloquence depends upon an energy of devastation. If they weren't killing you, they wouldn't be powerful, they wouldn't be effective. If they said something kind, it wouldn't work. So they have to be cruel, and they're very cruel. And they use words in a way that cuts right down to the blood and the bone. And I'm not good at that. And it hurts a lot, I'm telling you. And sometimes when I'm out there, I feel very lonely. And I'm not a tough guy. And I didn't grow up prepared for this. But, you know, I'm 71 years old. And I don't really care what they do to me now. I'm too old to bite my tongue. And no matter who I anger with my words, and no matter what the price I may be forced to pay, I intend to keep on fighting in this struggle to my dying day. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The wonderful room. Thank you. Beautiful people here.